Okay, so one of the sometimes in the necessity analysis, like you don't find any single conditions that is necessary. So what do you do in those situations? You can either calculate a necessity consistency score, so you can say, well, you know, this condition is not perfectly re necessary, so it's not always required all the time, but it's still present in like 90%, 95% of successful cases. So it seems to be, even though not strictly necessary, it seems to be quite important. So the chance of a case being successful, if that condition is not there, it's kind of low. And then another thing you can do is to look at these junctions or logical union of conditions. This is a bit like think of a disjunction or a union as a like as a requirement. So as an equivalent requirement. So the simplest example I can find is proof of identity. Like when you are required to provide proof of identity, you don't necessarily need to show your passport. If you show your passport, it's yes, it's proof of identity, but it's not the only thing that you can show. You can show your driving license or your identity card, your security card, whatever. So you have you know, any of those things serves as proof of identity, but none of those things is strictly required. So you can have a situation where you can say, well, no single condition is strictly required for this outcome, but at least one condition out of this group, yeah, it is. So this is known as a disjunction. And as you add condition in disjunctions, it's likelier to find a necessity relations, because adding condition in disjunctions is like this. This is the representation of combinations and conditions. So let's say that you have these two sets. And these are the projects, let's say they're projects, and they're projects with good institutional capacity, cap, and sufficient funding. Okay, and so inside, these are all projects with sufficient funding, and here, all the projects with good institutional capacity. In this area, this is the intersection. And these projects have both. So they're both good institutional capacity and sufficient fundings. So this is, it's a smaller one. It's a smaller area. So the combination is a small area because it needs to have both. But the union is a large area because this is about projects which have either good institutional capacity or sufficient findings. It doesn't need to be both. It can be just one of these two. So if you add conditions in this junction, you get larger and larger areas. And if we had seen that necessity is a superset analysis, so a condition is necessary if it sort of fully includes the outcome. So if you don't find any conditions like this, which fully includes the outcome, you can add other in this junction, then you're gonna get a larger and larger set. And you know, the chances of this larger and larger set fully includes the outcome increase. So that's one thing you can do. It's the opposite for the sufficiency analysis. We'll see this now. You want to add something? Oh yeah, of course. But only one software, only R, does it. So the other two don't. Okay, so this efficiency analysis is a bit the opposite. So instead of starting from successful cases, from the outcome, you start from single conditions. So you pick them one at a time. You have many. You start from single conditions, then you go through combinations of two, combinations of three. So it's something that you do across all sorts of single factors or combinations of factors. You don't do it, of course, the software does it. Likely. So you pick one combination or one condition and you ask yourself, is this condition or combination sufficient for success? Like if this condition is met, what are the chances of the case being successful? So how much does this condition or recipe guarantee success? In our specific case, there were some single conditions. This is not very frequent, but this is a small data set. There were three conditions which were by themselves sufficient. And it was accountability mechanism, the availability of the mechanics, and the sufficiency of funds. What do you do when no single condition is necessary, or no combinations is perfectly sufficient, not necessary, is perfectly sufficient? You can say, well, I'm not looking for perfect sufficiency. I'm just fine with like a 90% threshold. So, you know, I'll just go with identifying those combinations that are at least 90% consistent in terms of sufficiency. But you can also add other conditions, not in disjunction as before, but in combinations. Because if you add conditions in combination, then the set becomes smaller and smaller, as we've seen from the chart. And because of how sufficiency is defined, is a subset. So it's like as you add conditions in combinations, you get a smaller and smaller set, and the chances of the set being fully included in the outcome becomes higher. So it's a bit... maybe this is not very... You don't find the immediate usefulness of these things I'm saying, but this should be helpful in understanding the logic basis of QC, the mathematical basis, which is completely different from the other methods that I think we're familiar with. And this also explains why when you have combinations of many conditions, it's more likely that you have perfectly sufficient combinations, where if you have simple combinations of two or three conditions, the chance of them being perfectly sufficient is lower. So for example, when I do my analysis and I find perfectly sufficient combinations of four or five conditions, I'm not impressed. But you know, if I find, let's say, a relatively simple combination covering many cases, which is perfectly sufficient, then that's much more impressive. I say this is really useful because it's both perfectly sufficient and covers a large proportion of the cases, and it's relatively simple to understand. So that's what I call sort of a good finding. And this is also something I define in the guide. What is a satisfactory finding in QCA? So do you have any questions about this, or do you want to try this yourself in your data sets and see if there are any conditions which are consistently associated with a positive outcome? Sorry?
We've done that for our...
Oh, you've done this already? Okay, good. So any questions on this? No. Is it because everything is a blur, or is it...
on that table, could you show us which ones are the sufficient ones, just to make sure that I've gotten it right?
Yes. So... So this is sufficient because it's 1, 4, and 5, and 1, 4, and 5 are all successful. It's not many, it's just over three cases. And there's one chapter... Yeah, this is important, I should say that. So one pretty big section in the book is devoted to the assessment of this necessity and sufficiency statements on the basis of the number of cases that you are looking at. Because, of course, if it's just one... Let's say that one condition is observed in only one case. and it's successful, then you can say, oh, I have perfect consistency. Whenever I encounter this condition, I encounter success, but it's just one case. So, and if you have two, it's a little bit better, but it's still just two cases. So if you know, the same relation, the same consistency observed over two cases or over 15 cases has different meaning. So, like, what can you say about that and about, you know, the number of cases that you observe this relations on, and this relations. So this is information that it's useful to have, like, how many cases is this perfectly sufficient relation observed on? So this is one sufficient, subset sufficient conditions. This is not, because it's present here, but the outcome is negative. This is not, because it's present here in the absence. The outcome is negative, same here. This is subset sufficient because, again, it's line 1, 3, 4, and 5, and cases 1, 3, 4, and 5 are all successful. So we have two subset sufficient conditions here.
But the fact that 3, 1, 1, and 3, 2, 1 are always present in all successful cases, the same with 3, 2, 2, doesn't it mean that? I mean, it might be that the combination is sufficient, but not each of the conditions by itself.
No, sorry, which conditions are you talking about?
Take 3-1-1, 3-2-1, 3-2-2. They're all associated with a positive outcome in all cases.
You can't say that the 3-1-1
and none of them is... no, sorry, take 3-2-2. Take 3-1-1 and 3-2-1.
3-1-1 and 3-2-1, which are they're both subsets of... No, they're not... They're both subsets sufficient. Yes, they're both...
But it might be that it's the combination that is sufficient, and not the conditions individually.
But, yeah, that's an interesting thing about this type of sufficiency analysis, and that's a difference with the other type of sufficiency analysis that we look at. So this one... just cuts the data sets and completely ignores the other conditions. So you start from single conditions and you say, I want to see what's the association between this single condition and the outcome. And it completely ignores anything else. And when it analyzes combinations of two, it focuses completely on specific combinations of two and completely ignores the others. While with the other procedures that we will see immediately now, it's different. So maybe this is a nice introduction into the next procedure, if you don't have any more questions on this. It's not necessary. So it's not necessary, but it's sufficient because whenever I observe it, I mean, sufficiency can be trivial because you can, if it's just one condition, you can say, oh, whenever I observe this, it's successful, but it's actually you're talking about one condition. So this is three, it's not. Okay. So just cover this. Okay, so let's look at the other type of sufficiency analysis, which is also the most famous QCA procedures, and some people call this QCA. So just they think that QCA is just this thing. But actually, it's the difference with the other types of subset sufficiency is that instead of cutting the data set, it's a progressive synthesis of the data set, which is much more conservative in terms of simplifications. So it only simplifies the data set under very specific circumstances. And it will lead to, on average, more complex sufficiency statements than the subset analysis. So the first thing you do in the Boolean minimization is you create this so-called truth table, which is it's a first step towards simplifying the data set, but it's very conservative way to do it. So essentially what you do is you look at the data set, and some cases can be identical. because you don't look at everything, you only look at a limited set of conditions. So even though they're different cases, they might still have the same values over these conditions. So in the truth table, those two cases would be just one row, one combinations. So all the combinations in the truth table are different. I'll show you this example. So this was the data set. This was actually the other model. The outcome was processing of information, it's not repair. But it's still a data set with eight cases, I think it was, yes, eight cases. Some cases are similar. And this is the truth table, which is built from that data set. So you can see that all rows, so we went from a data set of eight cases to a truth table of five combinations. Because those eight cases only contain five different combinations. So for each different combinations, you don't have just the name of one case, but you can have more than one case, which is covered by the same combination. In this case, you have three. This is one, this is two. This combination covers two cases. This one doesn't really change. So it's a first way of simplifying the data set. You don't simplify the conditions are the same. You simplify the rows, essentially. So that's the first step. So what's the second step? What's the further step? A further step is to synthesize in the truth table with the so-called Quine-McCluskey algorithm, which Rick has mentioned before. So the way you do this is you merge almost identical rows. What does almost identical mean? It means combinations sharing the same outcome and sharing all the other conditions, all the causal factors except one. It needs to be at most one difference. That's the so-called one difference rule. So in practice, this means merging these two rows, for example. These two rows are identical except in the first condition, GSM reception. So you're allowed to merge these two. And the idea is that we are talking about causal analysis and we're trying to understand what are the causal factors that are relevant for outcomes. So if we're trying to understand what explains success, well, definitely success is not explained by GSM reception, because you can be successful whether or not you have GSM reception. So we can just kind of remove this. It's not relevant to understand success. That's the logic.
But then in the new table, you would have to remove 2-1-1, or you would have to define it as a 1.
Exactly. No, you remove 2-1-1. So in this case, you don't just remove cases. You don't just simplify the rows, but you also simplify the columns. So you will get a simpler a simpler combination. So like the same combination or the same case is not covered by a combination of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 conditions, but a combination of 6. How does this look? Yeah, this is what it looks like. So essentially, you go from this truth table of five combinations and each combination of seven conditions each to this list of pathways, which are three pathways, which is simpler. So two are six conditions, and then one, it's still seven conditions. So it means that we were able to merge two rows into one, two other rows into one, and then one row we just weren't able to simplify it. So you might not find this very useful, but this should give you an idea of the logic that is used to simplify the truth table. And then in some cases it simplifies more, in other cases it simplifies less, but this is how it works. Sorry, what do you mean simplify the causes?
Yes, that's the long together rows. Would you like to do that with columns as well? Are you thinking of making a comparison?
Well, you can. It sounds like merging conditions in a way. Yeah, you could do it. You could say, I mean, sometimes like when a condition, in some cases, like when a condition is like both necessary and sufficient for an outcome. It's like it's always there whenever the outcome is, and whenever you have that condition, you also have that. So it's like it seems like the same thing. You know, it's just sort of consistently associated with this in all sorts of directions. And I've had situations where, you know, at some point the principal investigator was like, but this is actually just another way to describe the outcome. So they realized that it was basically the same conditions. So I'm not sure this is the case here, but this is also something that you can think of. But this is just, I mean, the aim of this was just to explain to you how this minimization algorithm works. So in a way, you build, these are still sufficiency statements, and you can say, whenever I have these combinations, the outcome is positive. But they are more complex, and they are sort of, they are achieved by merging cases and not by sort of artificially cutting the data set across the conditions, which is what the subset analysis does. And then other things you can say is that, so we started from a data set of 8 cases, and we ended up with 2 pathways. So this is a complete synthesis of the data set. And in causal terms, it does not hide any information. So it kind of distills the information that is causally relevant for the outcome. And you don't lose any information in this sense. But it's just much simpler to look at and to understand, because it's just 2 pathways and not 8. And also, 2 of these pathways... both of these pathways are made of 6 conditions instead of 7, which might not be a big simplification. I mean, in this case, it was not a big simplification, but in other cases, it's better. Of course, I couldn't use like 5 different cases in the same example, but in the book you find different cases which are used to illustrate different procedures. Any questions on this? Any comments at all? Don't be afraid to say bad things.
It says to me that condition 2 on 2, 2 on 3, and 2 on 4, since they're always there,
yeah,
even though the outcome is positive or negative, it seems to me like fatal conditions.
So yes. Yes, that's actually a good point. And this is something that... I think we suggest it's at some point on the chapter making suggestions on how to reduce conditions. So one way to reduce conditions is to eliminate the necessary conditions. I think some of these were necessary in the first place. We didn't do the necessity analysis for this model, but some of these are necessary. So we could just... because in this type of... procedure in the Boolean minimization, you are synthesizing cases with a positive outcomes. You're not looking at cases with a negative outcomes. just positive outcomes. And from the necessity analysis, you might know that whenever you have a positive outcome, some conditions are positive. So essentially, in this group, which is group of positive outcome cases, you already know that the necessary conditions are always positive, because this is by definition. So why would you want to include them in the Boolean minimization? You know they're always going to be there, and they're always going to be positive. So that, you know, one suggestion is, if you need to reduce the number of conditions for the Boolean minimization, just remove the necessary conditions and work on the other ones. And you can always put them back at the end, but you don't need to sort of work, have the software perform the analysis on a model including necessary conditions.
So just taking the point that just been made, does that mean the solutions down the bottom can be simplified by reducing the second, third, and fourth, by removing the second, third, and fourth condition out of them? Because
They're not trivial. We don't know if it's trivial. I mean, I have to go back to the... I don't know if it's trivial. I don't remember. Maybe it is. This was the full... Oh, yeah, they're all trivial. You're right, it's always there. Yes. Yeah. So you can definitely remove all of that stuff. Shall we do it now?
Was it really necessary that you were talking about, or is it sufficient?
This one?
Yeah, the ones, the 2-1-2, 2-1-3.
They're trivial. Trivial, which means they're always there whenever the outcome is positive, but also whenever the outcome is negative. So they're not sufficient, because sufficiency would mean that whenever they're there, the outcome is always positive. In this case, it's sometimes positive, sometimes negative. But they're not, in a way, yes, they're necessary, because whenever the outcome is positive, they're always there. But they're also more than that. So they're trivial. So it means that doesn't really help you. It's a necessary condition, like a trivial condition is oxygen. Yeah. Like, you know, if you don't have oxygen, you don't have life. So if you don't have life, you don't have empowerment and all the other things. So it's just really not very informative, or in most cases. I mean,
respectively in Tanzania and Bolivia, can one fix it and save a project and achieve a good outcome by either learning something from Uganda or from the other successful cases? So
yeah, yeah.
It becomes very practical in this simple example for management. But that goes beyond the analysis itself. Analysis helps us bring us to the point where those questions can be asked.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, these algorithms are maybe not very interesting. Their only function is to make the data set readable, because some data sets are just too complex, and just, you know, the human eye and the human brain, just it's just too much information to process. So it's just a way to simplify the data set in a way that doesn't hide or remove any information that is causally relevant. And then once the data set is readable, you can use this information in any way you want, but this, you know, this phase is much more interesting than the actual algorithmic simplification. Yep.
So, of course, we have the room in the
back. Yep. Yeah. Yes, okay. Yes. So I'm going to... This is the third procedures. So I'm just skip ahead to the... okay, this was a simpler Boolean minimization of a simpler four-condition model. Just to make you understand that if you tested, let's say if you remove one condition and you test, instead of testing a five-condition model, you test a four-condition model, then you have different solutions, and you might want to compare and understand why is it different. I'm not going to talk about any of this. I'm such a big fan of the Venn diagram because this is very obvious in the book. I just sort of, about the Venn. Because I think once you get accustomed to it, and you understand what the areas mean, what the colors mean, and it's just a very quick, it's like at a glance way of understanding the information that's in the data set. You can see the necessity analysis, the necessary conditions, you can see the sufficient conditions, you can see everything at a glance. So it just takes a little bit of becoming familiar with it. Unfortunately, I don't have time to go through this now, but it's there's a whole section in the book devoted to this, and I highly recommend that. It's my favorite section. So I want to say something about the fourth procedure, which is something that was sort of introduced in this guide, which I think is very relevant for impact evaluation. So it's called the INES analysis because the cause that we're trying to see if the intervention E is an INES cause. So an INES cause is a cause which is not necessary in itself. It's not sufficient in itself, but it's still quite important because it's necessary for a combination to be sufficient. So first of all, it's part of a combination, and this combination is sufficient. It's unnecessary because there are different ways that you can reach success, but this combination as a whole is a good one. It's effective. And this condition, for example, the intervention, is a part of this successful combination. And now your question is, well, I know that the intervention is not necessary because it's not everywhere. It's not in all the successful cases. But is the intervention essential to this recipe? Is it essential for success here, locally, in this context? If the answer is yes, then you've discovered an INES cause. And you can see that because if you take that cause away from that specific combination, then you lose sufficiency, so the combination becomes unsuccessful. So if you can see this, you can see this in the data set. So for example, in testing the waters, I don't know what's the quickest way to see it. This is something that you can see in the Venn diagram, because you see in the Venn diagram, the green means success, and the pink means lack of success. And areas that are close to each other means that they're almost identical combinations. So I can see that these two areas represent almost identical combinations. This is 1111, and this is 1110. So it's like only the last condition is different. But apparently, this is makes a big difference for the outcome, because this combination is unsuccessful and this combination is successful. And the first three are the same. So I can build this result into an argument like the fourth condition makes the difference in the context described by the first three for success. If we go, this is the case of the, I think it was the ICT, it was the ICT process. Is the ICT reports being followed up? So it's like in the two cases covered by these combinations, ICT data are not analyzed. In the three cases covered by these combinations, ICT data are analyzed. And this is interesting because these two combinations that I am comparing, each of them covers three cases. No, one covers three cases, and the other covers two cases. And this is the same logic of using counterfactual analysis, because it's just one difference between two cases which are otherwise almost identical, which makes a difference for the outcome. And originally, this is not counterfactual analysis. This is Mill's method of difference, which is one way to establish causality, which again you can see in the annex A. So this was like the fourth procedures. And it's similar to Boolean minimization, so it works with the truth table as well, because you compare combinations. But in the Boolean minimizations, you compare combinations with the same outcome, and you look at similar factors or factors which are almost identical except one. In this case, you're still looking at factors which are almost identical except one, but the outcome is different. So that's it's a fourth way of doing it. Okay, concluding remarks. No, do we have time for concluding remarks? Okay, so essentially it's a nice tool to have in the toolkit. It answers questions that no other method really answers this clearly and this directly in a way which opens up such a close dialogue between data and theory. The procedures are fully transparent and replicable, so they're internally robust. You can make the argument that they're also construct robust because it forces teams to reflect on the concepts that they're using. It requires a high conceptual precision. And finally, it also allows limited generalization, which is something that qualitative approaches normally don't do. But there are also challenges, of course. So the first one is that usually there's a steep learning curve, but this is all in the past because now you have the book and everything's going to be easy. So and then a close collaboration between the PI and the QCA expert, unless the PI reads the book. And then another serious challenge is the time needed to do it to a satisfactory degree is usually unpredictable. There is also a bit of luck involved. So essentially, it depends. You can't really predict when you will find meaningful findings. But this is a testament to the rigor of the method. So it's not something that you can kind of you cannot force the method into do what you want it to do. You just have to trust that it will describe reality, and you don't know what this reality is like. Otherwise, you would need the method to describe it. So it requires well-developed or at least very specific theories of change. Requires at least 3 or 5 cases, and finally, sometimes it doesn't work, and just findings are too complex or just counterintuitive and just very difficult to interpret. Okay, so that's everything.
Thank you very much, Barbara. As we said in the beginning, the slides will be available.
Yep.
Online in 2 days or so, an online version of the book will be available as well for downloading at the EBA. And that will also include hyperlinks to the glossary, etc. So it will be fancy. So while maybe not being fledgling QCAers as of now, I do hope that this day has facilitated your continuous learning process and somewhat have flattened the steep learning curve. Our next seminar is sometime in late August, beginning of September, and I don't know exactly when, but if you've signed up for invitation to our seminars, you'll have it in due time. If you want to get in touch with Rick or with Barbara, I think their contact details will be on the slides. Otherwise, you will manage to get in touch with them through us at EBA. Thank you very much for today. Thank you for attending.